This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In Podcast Network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this, another brand new episode of the Cinema Recall Podcast here at thatmomentin.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on today's episode, we are going to be discussing a few scenes from Ridley Scott's 1982 sci-fi masterpiece, Blade Runner, as well as giving a look at the new Blade Runner 2049, directed by Denis Villeneuve. And joining me on the show, back again from our first episode, we have with us Mr. David Dupre, the owner of ThatMomentIn.com. Hello, good sir.
Hello, Vern. Wow, you know, off mic we were talking. We have been planning this episode in its various forms for almost 4 years. We've been wanting to talk about Blade Runner. And finally, here's our chance. I'm so excited.
I would say it too. I gotta say, man, this is probably my favorite sci-fi film of all time. I know a lot of people are into like Star Trek, and people are into Star Wars, and maybe there's a few people that are into The Matrix, but for me, it is Blade Runner.
Well, yeah, as you know, and if anyone who's even casually been to the website, thatmomentin.com, this is my all-time favorite. I don't back down. There hasn't been a film yet that's overtaken it. I have to defend it quite a bit as the years go by, but this is my all-time favorite film, so I'm really looking forward to talking about it with somebody who is also a fan, so let's get to it.
So yeah, before we get into our scenes here, I have to ask you, man, which version of this did you watch? Because there's like 7 or 5 different cuts of this movie here. So
believe it or not, I was young, but I was able to actually see the original in the theaters.
Really?
Yes, I was. I was in late middle school or something, but I was able to see it. No, early high school, actually. I'm a little older than most people think that I am. But and then since I've seen all the iterations, but my favorite really is the 2007 final cut version. That one just it strips away the narration. It's got the dream sequence with the unicorn, and it really is a really cohesive. I'm gonna echo what you said earlier. It's a real masterpiece. The 2007 version, the final cut.
Yeah. See, I have a different thing with Blade Runner. I first saw the Letterboxd VHS director's cut because I thought the box art looked kind of cool. There's a guy holding a gun, and so when smoking out the distance there, I'm like, I have no idea what this is. And I was probably like 13 years old when I first saw it. And when I first saw it, my reaction, I didn't love it right away. I was really impressed with the visuals of it. But the storyline, I couldn't get much into it with my 13-year-old brain. And then I started playing this game called Rise of the Dragon, which is the Sega CD point-and-click adventure game. And the main character of that game is a lot like Deckard. He's basically trying to find out. It's all about these people who are taking this drug, and this one girl gets addicted and dies, and you're trying to find out what happened with her. It's kind of a cool game, and so after watching that game or playing that game, I went back and rewatched Blade Runner again, and I got to love it even more. And then I saw the theatrical cut on like a pan and scan VHS, and then with the narration and the tattoo and happy ending, I'm like, oh, okay, well, I can totally see what they changed around here. And then I saw news about the final cut coming out, and yeah, that is definitely my preferred version. But once in a while, I will go back and watch the theatrical cuts. Sure. Because some of the narration of that one works, and some of it doesn't. I kind of want there to be a fan cut that has some narration put in and some of it removed.
There should be a fan cut out there, right? Yeah. I've never really been a fan of the narration, and I am with you. When I first saw the film in theaters, I was young too, and it didn't have the effect. At that time, Star Wars and Indiana Jones movies were coming out, and it was a much more action oriented. Those films were, but as I matured and as I saw the influence of Blade Runner, I became to really appreciate it. And by the mid 90s, it had just overcome every other film. And I honestly became obsessed reading so many books about the making of it. And there's so much about it that I got really involved in. And it just became like a little personal cult of mine. And I've yet to release it. Every time I watch it, I watched it just recently just to get geared up again for 2049. Mm-hmm. And I just sat in awe, like, from the very first note from the Vangelis theme, I'm like, it's a transcendent experience for me every time I watch it.
And I still read the book every year too.
Mm-hmm.
Do Andrew's Dream of Electric Sheep, because I think both the book and the movie, they go very well together. They're very different. We'll get into more of that when we discuss our scenes. But let's do this, as we always do. Let's take a short little break. We'll play some ads from some other great podcast shows. And then we'll be back to discuss a few of our favorite moments from Blade Runner.
We'll return after these messages.
Hey, this is Jacob Haller. In my podcast, Tell Me About Your Song, I call up all kinds of songwriters, jazz, rock, folk, electronica, whatever, and all levels of experience from just starting out to established national acts, and I ask them to talk about a song they wrote for about 20 minutes. So if you're interested in hearing creative folks talk about what they do, then check it out at tellmeaboutyoursong.com. Thanks.
Car breaks down the middle of nowhere. Now how am I supposed to get back home?
Oh my god, Kristen, is that you?
Oh my god, Vern, why are you in a field?
Oh, this is so great. I can't believe you drove all this way to join me on the film pasture.
Wait, you see, actually, I was on my way home and...
This is so cool. We can have, like, fellow podcasters and critics come on to talk about various topics, like how to get followers and get free movie screeners and all.
Maybe a mechanic is, like, close.
Oh, and we can each month we can have a roundtable discussion with various filmmakers talking about how movies are made. Oh, this is going to be so great. Thank you, Kristen.
Hi, do you know anyone that comes out this far? I'm in a...
Kristen! Are you trying to leave already?
Well, I mean, but... Of course not, Vern. I was just checking to see if there's a place that delivers food out here.
So, listen to The Film Pasture, available on iTunes, Podomatic, Stitcher Radio, and soon on YouTube.
What was the name of that cab company again?
What'd you say?
I was just asking Siri if, you know, they had bottles or cans.
Los Angeles, 2019.
There was an escape from the off-world colonies. They slaughtered 20...
The assignment? Track down 6 manufactured humans. He's the best man for the job. But he may die trying to prove it. Harrison Ford is the Blade Runner.
All right, we are back. You just heard a quick little trailer of Blade Runner. We're going to be discussing mainly the Final Cut version, talking about a few favorite scenes. David, let's start with you. What is your favorite moment of this movie? As you know what, David, let's do this. Before we actually do start to talk about the scene, we should actually talk about what this movie's about, because there may be people out there that have no idea what Blade Runner is about, and they're just clicking on our show at random here. But Blade Runner has Harrison Ford as Rick Deckard, and he is a guy who has been hired to hunt down and kill, I'm sorry, aka retire these
Republicans. Right.
That has escaped from an off-world colony. You see, in the future, replicants are basically human cyborgs, and they're meant to resemble everything that a human can do. And
more human than human.
Yeah, exactly. And they've been using these replicants basically to help clean up these off-world colonies so that humans can live there. You see, in this future, Earth has become so polluted that they've been taking citizens of Earth, actually, you know, the healthy ones, and putting them into these off-world colonies. And these replicants they hire, they go to these planets and help clear away all the dust and debris so that humans can live there. And
it's slave labor. It's a slave labor. That's what it is. That's the whole theme.
Totally slave labor. And
yeah, right.
About I think it was like six of them escape. They go to Earth. And this would be Roy Batty, Zora, and Pris. The three.
And Leon. Don't forget Leon.
Leon, that's right. Leon. They're the ones that kind of escaped to the colony there. And I think it was... I forgot the name of the guy that actually does do the interrogation of Leon. But he gets...
Holden.
Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
He gets stopped by Leon. And now Deckard has been called in. And he's been a retired Blade Runner for, like, years. And he just called back into duty. And he's hunting these replicants down. And that's kind of the storyline of it, though. He does get involved with another replicant named Rachel. And he starts to have feelings for her that he never felt for these, I guess, these beings before. And that's kind of the arc of the story there is. It's about this guy who's been hired to kill these replicants. He never sees them as being anything but, like, property, as someone's property. And he starts to develop personal feelings and love and emotions that he's never felt before. And it deals, too, about what it means to be human. Do memories make us human? But let's go ahead right now. Let's go ahead and get into your favorite moments of this
movie. Well, it's almost impossible. But, you know, I like the setup you just gave it. And I think they were going to naturally kind of intercut between this film and 2049. But I like how, you know, you mentioned how he's been retired for a bit and he's getting pulled back into this mystery, this job. And in the original 1982 version, Blade Runner, there it seems to have purpose. Like he's so good at his job that the police chief Bryant wants him on the job. But then we learn in 2049 that actually there's an ulterior motive behind that. There's another purpose for why he's been chosen. I think that's what makes 2049 really good as well. Mm-hmm. And it's also very interesting. You said, you know, in the future, when the story actually takes place in 2019, right? And I remember when, you know, in 1982, when it came out, 2019 seemed, you know, forever away, and now it's practically here. So, it's so difficult to really stop and say this is my favorite moment, but there are some moments that I would like to talk about. Just quickly, I just for the sake of speed of the show, but I'm sure you've heard of this this issue that's been coming up a lot lately, and rightfully so, with the violence, that one violent scene where Deckard and Rachel have this sort of love moment, a romantic moment, but it's more of a domestic violence, and it's been getting a lot of slack lately. Have you heard about this?
Oh yeah, when he's like basically so the scene we're kind of set up right now is when Rachel is with Deckard and she goes to leave, and then he grabs her and he just lightly shoves her because why I always saw that scene. Here's a scene where he's in love with her, she's in love with him, but yet these are new emotions for this person. I mean, she's time she's feeling these things, and she's scared. And if you notice, too, when he does grab, when she starts to walk away, he's like, look, I'm not letting this girl get away. So he grabs her, and he shoves her, but if you see his hands, he bats off.
Like, and then he starts to say, like, he starts to guide her by saying, like, you know, tell me to kiss you, tell me to touch you. I've watched a few well-made video essays on YouTube by some very reputable people who have been really coming down hard on this scene. And, you know, the current state, of course, as it should be, especially with the whole Weinstein thing that's happening now with abuse and white male entitlement and this sort of thing, it does have echoes of that. But I think this scene has been vastly blown out of proportion because it is a character, and we have to remember too that he is experiencing something new for himself, especially if we piece together all the clues from this movie. And it makes a lot more sense when we piece it together with 2049, when we realize ultimately what he is and how both of these people are experiencing something for the first time.
Yeah.
And I think what's happening is people are taking this singular moment without the context of the entire broad story and condemning this part of the film. And I don't think it's right. And there's one video essay that I watched where the person was condemning Harrison Ford's many movie characters, Indiana Jones and Han Solo, as a serial violent man who dominates women. And I, again, these are characters, and I think that they fit properly in their stories. And I'm not even coming close to, saying that I advocate this kind of behavior, but I'm saying that, especially if we're going to stick to Blade Runner, I think this moment is getting a lot of too much slack, because it's actually very revealing of both of them. And yes, what he does is wrong. And as you just pointed out, he quickly realizes what he's doing.
Yeah.
And it becomes, and Rick Deckard is a man of violence. This is what he's, and this is what the whole point is. He's burdened by that violence. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason I bring this up, Vern, is because the moment I really want to talk about is what precedes this, follows this, is when he tracks down Zora, and she's one of the replicants played by Joanna Cassidy. And she's the one who gets the least amount of screen time, but her part in this is really crucial. She is kind of hiding out in a sort of a nudie bar, basically, where she does erotic dancing with a replicant snake.
Which I always wanted to see. I've seen storyboards about how they were going to shoot the scene with her in the snake and the pit and everything that. Would have been amazing.
Yeah, but I'm kind of glad they didn't. I've heard that too. I'm glad they didn't, because I think that reaction that Deckard has, the acting that Ford has when he kind of turns away from the stage, says everything I need to know about what that performance was.
Sure.
But what happens is he's tracked her down, and let's not spoil too much, but he very cleverly tracks her down and goes backstage disguised as a writer for an ethics magazine. And so he basically reveals himself accidentally, and she realizes that he is out to get her. And so she makes this escape into the city, and she goes into the subways or part of the subway, and then she comes out, and then there's a chase through traffic and then a department store. And spoilers here, I guess we're going to have to deal with this. She's running, he shoots her in the back as she's barreling through this cavalcade of glass everywhere. Mm-hmm. There's so much that we can unpack here.
Let me go back to the beginning part of the scene when he's first when he first sees her outside of the club. He pretends to be this really nebbish, nerdy mm-hmm. guy that wants mm-hmm. to know if anyone is poking holes in her dressing room and make mm-hmm. sure that no one is taking advantage of her.
Excuse me, Miss Salome, can I talk to you for a minute? I'm from the American Federation of Variety Artists.
Oh, yeah?
I'm not here to make you join. No, ma'am. That's not my department. Actually, I'm from the Confidential Committee on Moral Abuses.
Committee of Moral Abuses?
Yes, ma'am. There's been some reports that the management has been taking liberties with the artists in this place.
I don't know nothing about it.
Have you felt yourself to be exploited in any way?
How do you mean exploited?
Well, like to get this job. I mean, did you do or were you asked to do anything that's lewd or unsavory or otherwise repulsive to your person? Huh?
Are you for real?
Oh, yeah. I'd like to check your dressing room, if I may.
For what?
For holes.
Holes?
Well, you'd be surprised what a guy would go through to get a glimpse of a beautiful body.
No, I wouldn't.
The little dirty holes they drill in the walls so they can watch a lady undress.
Actually, they took that moment from a Humphrey Bogart movie called The Big Sleep. There's a moment
in The Big Sleep
where Humphrey Bogart is dressing like a book sailor to basically get information about this mm-hmm. one librarian. and he talks in like this nasally voice, and yeah, Harrison Ford yeah. is kind of mimicking that when he talks to Zora. And there's also elements too that happen with the book as well. Like he asked her, "Is this a real snake?" And she says, "Of course not. Do you think I could work here if I could afford a real snake?" Which is a throwback to the book, because in the book, it's more detailed that animals are very rare. Like a lot of animals have become extinct, and a lot of people on Earth have like these electric animals. And if you could own a real animal, you actually have real wealth, because I know in the book, Deckard is trying really hard to afford this sheep. That's the main reason why he's going to retire these replicants. Right. In the book, it was called Andes, but he's doing that so he can afford to buy a real sheep.
So. Oh, there's so much happening here. Like that, even the voice that Deckard decides, you know, that nebbish voice he takes on. You know, I recently watched a video on YouTube from CinemaSins and the guy he picked on that scene, saying that why would he change his voice if he's never met her before? Well, she wouldn't know what his voice is, right? So, but I'm like, that you're missing that. My feeling is that's not the point. The point is he is creating a vulnerable character, a weak character, to make her feel like she's got the upper hand, right? That's the whole point of that, is to make himself appear like he's not able to defend himself against her, that he's completely non-threatening, which is what he's trying to be, and I think he pulls that off.
But to be fair, too, he's kind of non-threatening, because she does kick his ass. In fact,
he gets kicked everywhere in this movie, right?
He just ass kicks a lot in this movie, right, to be fair, right? Oh, she says, "Tell me," and then she just elbows him right there, and then she chokes him. And this part, this is one small complaint. She's choking them. You know, she's like tying his necktie tight, choking him bad, and then she stops and runs out. And I'm just kind of curious about what your thoughts of that is. I mean, she has the guy dead right there. Why do you think she decides to run?
Well, because if you listen to the soundtrack, you listen carefully, it is distracting, I agree. She's basically throttling him with his own necktie. But the show on stage ends. And the act is coming down the hallway towards the dressing room. And so she gets distracted by the sound of approaching act, and someone's going to come in the dressing room. So she's going to get caught. So she quickly nails him in the throat and then takes off. Timed, because but this is my thinking is, would she have succeeded? How long would Decker have allowed that to happen? Right. I mean, is she that powerful? Especially since we know ultimately what Deckard is, the clues are there throughout the Blade Runner, especially the final cut version, and that's confirmed in 2049. Yes. How long is going to let that happen, right? So
that's
curious, but So they take it to the streets, and you know, here's where Ridley Scott, the director, indulges, and I think it's fantastic. You know, as you mentioned very early in the podcast, you said that you were taken by the visuals and the setting and the production of it. And this film is so what's the word? It's so heavy, so dark, and so atmospheric. And it's moments like this where it could have been a straight up, it could have cut directly from him or she exiting the dance hall and then going right to the department store, and then he chases her down and shoots her. But instead, it was like a 3-minute montage of the city, and we just get absorbed into the chase, and we see how packed it is, the socioeconomic instability of the people, we get a feeling of the pulsing of the city, we hear the sounds of what it's like to live there. We get a tour of what it's like to be in this oppressive place.
Do you set up the shots?
I think it's brilliant.
David, to set up the shots of Deckard hunting Zora through the city had to take forever. Basically, to coordinate the extras and everything, and make sure that both Deckard and Zora are laid in frame, made sure that the extras make their same beats and paths each time they do a take, has got to take a lot of setup, a lot of skills, which explains why the movie went over budget, why it took so long to shoot. You can totally see that when you're seeing him chasing her through the alleyway. There's that one moment when you see Zora kind of peering off in the corner there. So there's like a bunch of people passing by her, and you see just her face out there in the corner, just waiting for her right moment to escape, and the light just hits her face perfectly. That had to take a long time to set up here, because you want to make sure that the... Because she's more in the background right there, the extras are more in the foreground, and you have to make sure that your lighting is just right so you can make sure that she's the face that the audience sees, even though the other extras are in the foreground there. So yeah, it took a lot of time to do that.
Well, there's so much about, and I invite people who are going to watch this movie or haven't seen it yet or are going to rewatch it to really let themselves get involved in this moment, because the soundtrack disappears and it just becomes the noise of the traffic, the walk, don't walk, don't crosswalk voices, and the, you know, the off-world blimp, the blimp hanging above us. There's just so much sound and atmosphere to this. It is really, it's a brilliant scene. But what it comes down to is him making this choice to shoot a woman in the back. Now, you know, metaphorically, symbolically, I guess, you know, there's a feeling of cowardice of anyone who shoots another person in the back. And we've seen that in cowboy westerns and whatever. But here we have a fleeing unarmed woman who we know is a replicant. And we have some sympathy already for these replicants. And then we have our hero, who, you know, we were desperately trying to get behind, shoot a woman in the back. And then, and Ridley Scott, you know, the really lets that, lack of a better term, impact of that shot really settle in, because he cuts to slow motion and she stumbles through pane after pane of glass, which itself becomes metaphorical of her breakdown. And I just think that it's a beautiful, haunting and tragic scene, and I like how he comes through it at the end. He actually, you know, and this is important. He walks through the path of her destruction, of as she goes down and smashes the glass. He walks through that, goes to her, and he, you know, he checks to see that's her for sure. And then he says he's done. He tells Bryant pulls up and he's like, I'm done. And this is the end of it. And it's a very revealing scene, and I've always been taken by the cinematography of it, the momentum of it, and the emotion of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's kind of a change in point for him, where he actually does feel guilt about what he does. I do kind of want to talk about a little behind-the-scenes making of the scene, because as a lot of people know, when in the original cut to this movie, they used a stunt double.
Yes.
They put on a very bad wig on the stunt double, and you can totally see that is not the same person.
Yeah, especially in slow motion. It was pretty obvious it was a stunt double.
Very, it was very kind of jaunting. So I'm kind of glad that for the final cut, they got Joanna Cassidy to come back and able to like superimpose her face over
the
stunt work to make it more impactful right there. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that, David. No, it's wonderful scene, very kind of tragic for both characters, obviously, right there. It's funny, too, because in the book, he's hunting this opera singer called Luba, who is supposed to be kind of the Zora character, and he kind of hunts her down in similar fashions with her. But in the book, though, he finally catches up with her outside in like a, I guess it was a hover card, and that's when, now he doesn't retire her, someone else does, who's also a replicant that retires her there. Brilliant scene right there. Anything more you want to add to that, or should I get to mine?
Let's go right to yours. Let's keep going.
All
right,
man. Well, the moment that I'm going to talk about is the one when, so begin the movie, Deckard's been hired by Bryant to hunt down these replicants, but he has to go meet, the owner of the replicants, Joe Tyrell. And right now I'm just totally blanking.
Eldon Tyrell.
Yes, thank you. Eldon Tyrell, played by, I think it was Joe Turkel.
Joe Turkel. There you go.
You'll remember him as being the bartender in The Shining.
That's right, yes.
So he goes there to basically put the Voight-Kampff test. And if you don't know what the Voight-Kampff test is, this is the device that Blade Runners use to see if someone is a replicant or not. So he goes there to test this out on a replicant, and Tyrell says, "Well, go ahead and try it on Rachel." And Rachel is a stunning blonde. I'm sorry, not blonde. Rachel is a stunning brunette, played wonderfully. Sean Young, just beautiful. Like her hair, everything just total resembles
40s
noir. Fatale, just great. And
stunning.
She sits down and she says, "Do you mind if I smoke?" He says, "It's not going to affect the test." And one of my favorite images of Blade Runner is her smoking. And I don't know why, but I always, for me, Blade Runner has that image of her on that desk with the smoke growing around her. And
I like how she, it looks like she doesn't know how to smoke yet. Did you see that? How she,
she's kind of fumbling around the cigarettes right there. She doesn't
quite know. And the lighter,
And then he puts up the device to her, and he starts asking her a series of questions. Like, you see a full nude, page layout, and what do you think about that? And she goes, "Is this testing whether I'm a replicant or a lesbian, Mr. Deckard?" And then he talks about, you see, there's a dinner, and they're serving boiled dog, and going through all these questions with her. And I'll even talk to you about a later scene with her and Decker inside of his apartment. But he's going through all these questions with her. And Tyrell says, "Rachel, why don't you step outside?" And Decker goes, "Well, she's a replicant, right?" And Tyrell goes, "Well, geez, how'd you know that?" And she doesn't know. And because it took him like over 100 questions.
Right.
And usually when Blade Runners test replicants, it doesn't take that long. But for
20 questions, right?
Yeah, 20 questions here. For her, it took like a lot longer than that. And he asked her, "Well, she doesn't," and Tyrell says, "Well, she's beaten to expect." And Decker's like, "Well, how does she not know?" And, you know, she's like, he tells him that they implanted memories into her. All right. Which brings up a whole new thing of replicants, because once they have memories about themselves, they're going to start thinking about the lives. And this is something I didn't mention in the beginning here, but replicants have only a 4-year lifespan.
And 4 years.
They put the memories in them to basically give them some sort of like cushion, some sort of comfort there. So they have other things to go back on. That's why Lian has his photographs. That's why you see a photograph with Rachel, or supposedly Rachel and her mother, which most likely is not it, because it's all supposed to be Tyrell's nieces.
Tyrell's niece, right.
And then there's a scene that sort of echoes this back when Deckard goes back to his apartment and Rachel shows up and he tells her certain things about her past that she never told anything, or she never told anyone. The whole moment when she played doctor with her brother, the thing about the story about the baby spiders. I'm not going to go into too much details, but when you watch the movie, you can see. But he knows everything that Rachel is doing.
You think I'm a replicant, don't you? Look. It's me with my mother.
Yeah? Remember when you were 6? You and your brother snuck into an empty building through a basement window. You were going to play doctor. He showed you his. When it got to be your turn, you chickened and ran. Remember that? You ever tell anybody that? Your mother, Tyrell, anybody? You remember the spider that lived in a bush outside your window? Orange body, green legs. Watched her build a web all summer. Then one day there's a big egg in it. The egg hatched.
The egg hatched.
And
100 baby spiders came out. And they ate her.
implants. Those aren't your memories. They're somebody else's. They're Tyrell's nieces.
Right,
he's
right.
Like, they're memories. They're not yours. They're someone else's. And she gets upset, and he feels bad about that. He feels bad that mm-hmm. upsets her, and he's like, you know what? Forget it. You're not a replicant. Go home. No, I mean, mm-hmm. go home.
Yeah.
And then she does leave, and I have a sense that he feels really kind of bad about that, and this is the first time.
Yeah, he goes out on the balcony, looks out, he's all sad, right?
Mm-hmm. But I kind of chose this moment right there, not only because I think it's beautifully staged. I think that Terrell's office is just wonderful set designs. I like the way that you see, like, just little slimmers of light kind of dance around. They look like almost waves.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
In the background right there.
But
here's the scene, too, where Decker's like, you know what, I'm just going to do this job. I don't want to do this. And then when he does meet Rachel, and I think it's when she kind of, like, twists his questions around.
Mm-hmm.
That's when there's – because here's someone that can challenge him a little bit.
Yeah.
Maybe he's never had that before. And right. I think that's just one of the first moments of those two kind of connecting in a small way. And what I liked about this movie, too, is that these two characters, they don't, like, fall in love right away. In fact, for most of the movie, they kind of hate each other. He tries to call her at the bar when Thor's playing there. And she's like, he's like, why don't you come down with me and have a drink? And she's like, that's not my terrible place. I don't think so. And he's like, oh, all
right. Yeah. She just hangs up on her, right?
Which nuts. I was not expecting that when I first watched that scene. But I kind of like that when you have, like, kind of, like, two, like, characters kind of opposing each other, but yet it seems like they like engaging with each other. They like trying to challenge each other's viewpoints right there. So I just enjoyed just seeing that dynamic. And it's just two people in a chair with like little wires attached to people's heads. I enjoyed that very much. In the book, Rachel is very much different because I think it was Bryant or Gaff or someone in the book says that, you know, it's okay to have sex with a replicant. Just, you know, don't get too attached. And when you're done, go ahead and kill them. And in the book, they actually do go out to a hotel. Now, I should tell you this, too. In the book, Deckard is married, all right?
Yes.
He does have a wife in the book. And so both Rachel and Deckard actually have to go out to a hotel room. And they do have sex. And afterwards, yes, I'm going to spoil things from the book here. Rachel, he does kill the goat that he buys.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. Trust me, I could probably do a whole episode just about the
book. Yeah, the book alone is quite different.
A lot of things in there. But yeah, that's kind of much all I really have to say about that particular moment.
Well, I think that moment is really important. I think it is an important moment. I don't talk over you there, but I think that moment is, again, it's another stunning visual that enhanced, it just shows you about the attention to the production design of the film. It relates a lot to the audience about the massive scale and size of the Tyrell Corporation. I think it's important too that Deckard goes into this thinking he's testing a human, and
yes,
so
that's right.
already. He's not on guard for, I mean, he's not, I don't think he's, you know, when you know you're testing for a replicant, you probably have some guard up or somewhere, you know, something, but he's assuming he's just, you know, indulging Tyrell and say, okay, I'm gonna do this woman first. But it's like the cigarette thing is just that initial hint for the audience. It's so well done. It's just as a small little gesture she makes, and instantly everyone in the audience is like, oh, wait a minute, that's not normal, right? Then we get the first bit with the eyes, and the eyes that glow, and it is a really atmospheric scene. It's so well done. And you know, okay, and the thing that comes after that, when you said when she goes to his apartment, all of this again, and I think this is a good point to pivot to 2049, because after watching after experiencing 2049, I view the original Blade Runner really differently. the now that we know the purpose behind what Deckard is to Rachel, based on 2049, I really feel differently about Blade Runner. And I think that itself, and I know that you only gave the film, I think you gave it 3 stars out of 5, right? I think you gave it 3 out of 5,
yeah.
Yeah, and for me, I'm 4.5, maybe 5. I really, I was really taken by this film. And basically because it's a perfect sequel. It respects the original, it builds on the original, and answers even questions I didn't think I wanted answers to. It answers those questions, and it really made the first film more impactful for me, if that makes sense.
It does. Do you want to get into our conversation about Blade Runner 2049?
Let's do it.
All right, well, let's do this right now. Let's go ahead and just kind of play a quick little snippet of Blade Runner 2049, and we'll be back with the thoughts, all right?
Okay.
I think it's challenging to talk about this film without saying anything about it. I've never worked on anything that's so, and rightfully so, you know, shrouded in secrecy.
Sent Harrison Ford the scripts, and he said, this is the best script I've ever read.
What was always wanting was a story that flowed naturally out of the first.
What do you want?
I thought you might be able to help me.
The first Blade Runner sent a shockwave in the world. At the beginning, we agreed what we were doing was deeply exciting, that it was a privilege.
There are films that come along and strike a chord. They become part of the way you see the world.
In this movie, the lighting, the camera, it's like a character in itself.
This Blade Runner is a new genius at work.
It's the same kind of color palette, but so made by another painter.
The film is incredible. It's haunting.
Key to the future is finally unearthed.
Before we get into Blade Runner 2049, yes, there will be spoilers, all right? We're going to try our best not to do too spoilerific because we want you to enjoy the movie, but yes, there may be some slip-ups here and there, so
yeah.
If you've never seen the movie, you really should try and see it on IMAX. I saw it at Dolby Cinema, but try and see it on the biggest screen you can possible.
It's with the best audio system.
Oh, gosh. Watching Dolby Cinema. Oh, wow.
Yeah, the audio was amazing. Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, I want to kick things off, okay. Vern. I really want to say it, and I'm glad I got this opportunity to talk to you about it because I listened to your podcast about it, and I know you had to keep it brief because you didn't want to spoil too much, and but you were very articulate in many points, and I think that your feeling about the film overall was well stated, and you mentioned that you felt that there wasn't a lot of the conversation starters about larger themes that Blade Runner seems to have. Obviously it has. We're still talking about it 30 years later, right?
Yeah.
So I want to counter that by saying I think that there was plenty there. I walked away with I walked away with less ambiguity than I did with even the Final Cut version. I think 2049 really solidifies a lot about what I thought about the original one and how it ends together in 2049. And I'm not going to lie, I'm biased because my feelings for Blade Runner are so strong. But I honestly may have even mentioned this to you at one point where I did not even want to see 2049 because I really felt that Blade Runner was a complete story, and the ambiguity, even the slight ambiguity of who or what Deckard is, was enough for me to say, I like that mystery and I don't want the answers. So when I did go to see 2049 and I embraced that, and then I realized they are going to answer the questions, and I was like, okay, they did it intelligently. It was a challenge at the same time, and it felt right. It felt organic to the original. So, and again, I don't want to spoil too much. You're right. That's probably not a good idea because it's still in theaters. But I really feel that this is probably, I'm just going to come out and say, I think this is the greatest sequel ever made.
You know what? And I'll go with that too. I do think it's a really well done sequel, especially a sequel that came out many years later. The sequel feels like it could have just came out 10 years later or so. Right. And it would still have been perfect here. I had no problem with any of the cast or the action there. But for me, because we're watching this movie mainly through Kay's perspective. Kay, of course, is played by Ryan Gosling. You find out very early on that he is a replicant that has been built to hunt down other replicants.
Right.
And then there's a mystery shown up there where his job is, okay, so in the movie, you find out that replicants have given birth. And
yes.
There's a child out there, and he has to go ahead and retire this child because it would just spell a disaster, which was told by Robin Wright's character. And through the mystery of it, though, he starts to discover that this child may be him, and then he starts to hunt down Rick Deckard, and you find out that him and Rachel had a child, supposedly. But the first part of the movie is just him trying to discover who he is and where he's coming from. There's a whole sequence with the wooden horse that he has. Mm-hmm. He's remembering where he hid that. So for me, the movie was a lot like him trying to discover who he is. There's a great sequence with him and his sort of like virtual girlfriend, Joy, played by Ana de Armas, who is amazing in this role. Amazing.
Yeah.
The moments when they do bring a droid for her to, I guess, superimpose herself over her body. I don't know how the hell they shot that, but that was just a glorious moment right there. But for me, it's like the whole movie is just him trying to find out more about where he is. And the thing I was talking about, the less themes there, I just didn't think there was enough about the replicants. I think there's a great character. There could have been a great character with the Jared Leto character, because in this movie, Jared Leto's character, William something, and I'm just totally blanking on that name right now.
Neander Wallace. He plays Neander Wallace.
Yeah, Neander Wallace right there. Yeah. He has created these replicants that, you know, live for a long time, but they are even more subservient than the other replicants are. Because right now, Kay is retiring replicant 8. These are the replicants that can live forever, which explains Rachel's character living for so long, especially at the end of the movie when they both escape and you hear the line there, she may not live forever, but that agent who does will find out that he is right there. So what I was trying to get, my point I was trying to get to, David, is the fact that it seemed to be more about kind of like a chase movie than it does try to bring up any of those themes about what it is to be human here. What's the difference between robots and humans, if humans or robots can have memories in them and they know about their lives? Because in Blade Runner, Roy Batty is just trying to find a way to extend his life. I mean, he knows when his end is going to be, and he's trying to find
I don't know, man. I don't know how you can say that, because I just, like, you've already mentioned two parts that I feel answer that question. The first thing is the wooden horse, which is basically the unicorn from the first one. Okay. It is the MacGuffin. It is the idol that represents the humanity, that memories do define us. And here, it is fantastically done. When that reveal comes, then when he actually goes and finds out that the wooden horse is real and he actually did put it there, or so we believe, it's heartbreaking. And yes, I'll tell you why.
Okay.
I will tell you why, because it you also mentioned the other side of the seesaw, which is that scene when his girlfriend and the other woman, you didn't mention her name, but her name is Mariette. She's played by Mackenzie Davis. Now we have to. Let's just quantify this a little bit. The love, was that her name? Yeah, love, or Joey. Yeah, Joey.
Joey, yes, Joey.
By Anna DeMars. Yeah. Oh, Joey is his in-home holographic woman, basically. And, you know, she's at this for so long, she's bound by the gadget that is in the house. It's suspended on the ceiling and projects her around the home, and she becomes anything that he wants her to be. And the film does a great job showing that as she flickers between a woman in a dress or a housewife, or, you know, she's all different kinds of personalities to him. And the AI in this holograph is very advanced and has become almost sentient. It occupies emotions. It builds on their history and has genuine feelings. This holograph has genuine feelings for Kay. And this moment so she actually hires a street girl, we believe is a street girl, to come into the house and represent her physical body. And then she syncs up with her, and it is a breathless moment when it goes on for an extended time where the two of them are moving together as she tries to stay in step with the real woman's body. And it allows for Kay to emotionally connect with Joy while physically connecting with the other woman. Her name's what is her name? I forget her name. Mariette. I just said it. Mariette. And I think that is the movie right there. But that's the argument you're looking for, Vern. You're saying that it doesn't have the answers about. Go ahead.
Okay. You do bring up a good point right there. Okay, yes, that sequence, that's what I'm saying. The sequence with him and Joy and him trying to give, you know, trying to establish love for her. And I think it's after that scene, she decides to, you know, she gets rid of that girl and she wants to be involved with him. And I feel in the same way, too, she wants to kind of escape from him as well because I feel like after that moment when she's finally able to give him the physical love that she's never able to give him anymore, she, in a way, can kind of, like, let him go. And, yes, you do bring up a good point right there. I feel like this is a movie that I got to watch again.
He brings home this new upgrade, right, yes, that releases her from the projector that's on the ceiling, where she's bound by the projector, can't move anywhere outside this projector. And now there's an enhancement that makes her portable.
You're right.
But the problem is, if he goes all the way with this upgrade and the portable device is destroyed, she is destroyed. And what does she say? Just like a real girl, she says. Oh, man, I was floored by that. Like, that's the Pinocchio effect, right? She wants to be a real person.
That's true. Okay, I never thought about it that way before. All right, you kind of opened my eyes to, like, do different things in the movie here. Now, but I don't want people to think that I don't really care about the Joy and Kay sequences, because that's, like, one of my favorite moments of.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because I became heartbroken too when he takes her, I guess, outside, because he's finally able to walk around with her too, and they're having a conversation just like a real couple. My heart broke when a phone call came through.
Yes.
Robert's character, and you find out that she actually is just a device.
The hologram. Right.
And that just kind of broke my heart in two when you find out that she still is. She's able to move around the place there. She's able to, discover her humanity.
Well, not only that, we even find out later she's not even unique. We see her in two billboard ads. Ginormous holographic billboard ads, and that's also a little bit heartbreaking. Like, she's not even unique. So that again, there's another layer to that, right? She wants to be unique. She wants to be a real girl that's separate from everything else that she is. So I think that's great. Yeah, but go on.
No. I think you just kind of saw everything that I wanted to do about that scene here. Because you made it kind of sound like my thing wasn't about the joy so much right there.
Right.
It's going to make me sound like I'm a complete hater of this movie, and I'm not.
No, you're not. I know you didn't. You were very positive in your review, and I think very constructive as well. Yeah. But I just wanted a chance to have to maybe offer some counter to what you were saying about that. And I'm not saying I'm right, but I'm just saying that's how I interpreted it.
There's new themes right there, too. Let's try to get into talking here about when Deckard shows up. Now, let me ask you this.
Fantastic.
Do you think that they should have put Harrison Ford in the trailers of this? Or would it have been better to have just been surprised?
100% take him. I refused to watch the trailers. I didn't watch the trailers. I honestly did not watch the trailers until I watched the movie. I went back and watched the trailers. And you know why I did that? Because they spoiled him in the Star Wars trailers, right? How awesome would that have been to go to Star Wars and see, Han Solo and Chewbacca are in this movie? They actually showed the reveal of both of those characters in the trailers, right?
Yeah.
And I understand that's going to get a lot of fans in the seats, right? And the big question is, is Han Solo going to be in the new Star Wars film? Oh, is Rick Deckard going to be in the new Blade Runner? And your answer is, let's go find out, right? Let's go find out. And they literally showed the moment when he comes to this, and just like, okay, so that whole moment would be for fans, like, here comes the moment, he's coming, we've already seen it. So I think it's a mistake, but it's just the way trailers are now, right, Vern? They're little mini movies all the way through. They give the entire story away.
So we get Deckard showing up, and he's living in this glorious house right there, but we also get kind of sequences of Deckard and Rachel when Kay is hunting through clues. We see here the audio of them at the interrogation, which sort of a good way to sort of connect the first one with the second one. What I love the most about the second movie is the fact that you could watch it by itself. It's nice.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
To know what happens in Blade Runner, but you really could watch this movie by itself and enjoy it on its own right there. But I do want to just talk really quickly. When he does show up, and he thinks that Kay is out there to kill him,
that's why he's hiding, right? Yeah,
he's hiding right there too. Yeah. And I forget, because I only seen this movie once, but I think Kay says, "Look, I'm not here for you," or somewhere out there. And they get into a fight sequence. I want that Living Room area with all the holograms.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Elvis hologram and
that was great.
Hologram.
That was great. Yeah.
And you went after that fight sequence happens, and they actually do sit down and have a drink. He starts to figure out more things about Deckard.
Yes.
And it's there he finds out that both him and Rachel were both being hunted. And they had to escape to this area, which is way outside the city limits. I'm trying my best not to get into too much spoilers.
Well, it's almost impossible at this point. Yeah, but okay. I will just, and I won't. I mean, we've said a lot already, but those moments are really crucial too, as it allows us to start piecing together our own theories about who Kay is in relation to Deckard, and you know, the film really does a great job of steering us towards an expectation, and of course that expectation gets pulled out from underneath us.
Because it was this moment too, it's in this moment here too, that don't we still think that Kay could be that kid that he's supposed to be hunting?
Yeah, that's the whole point, right? You're supposed to be thinking this.
Yeah,
because
just work for audience here, because while he's trying to hunt down this kid that is supposed to retire, he starts to think that he's this replicant child that got birthed, and he's trying to find out who this cop is, because he's the one that's dealt with this before. But in a way, it becomes sort of a scene between like a son and his dad.
That you just said it right. There's again. Here's another issue. This that helps to define that. Here's a boy looking for his father. Right. Yeah. We're trying to find his humanity. Do I have a dad? Mm-hmm. I'm and you know, Villeneuve does a really great job of establishing over and over that K is a replicant and on many levels is what we expect of a replicant. He's stoic. He doesn't seem to be very emotional. You know, he goes to the modern version, the 2049 version of the Voight Kampff, which is a sterile white room where they ask these questions and he just has to, and they test him to see if he's got all these markers to identify if he's feeling any emotions towards him. He doesn't until it happens again when he does. So we see the evolution in him and we realize, wow, a sense of place is so important in defining who you are. And to know that first he realizes maybe his all those memories he has are not right, or they actually are even more devastating, and he might have a father. What? You know, so these are issues for me that were just, I was just, my chest was like, oh my God, this is really powerful stuff. See, and go ahead.
You're bringing up like a lot of good points with this, what makes me kind of rewatch this again, because I'll be honest, when I first saw the first Blade Runner, it was one of those movies that I didn't much understand it. I was kind of following the plot of a guy growing up and hunting replicants, but then each time you watch it, new layers get exposed. And right. I have a feeling that when I do rewatch Blade Runner 2049, more layers are going to get exposed and explored, and I'm going to see new things about Joy. I already saw new things. I'm trying to look her up right now. The character that Robin Wright played in the movie there, she plays basically Kay's boss in this. And when you first watch it, you think that she is sort of like the bad guy. And even she has different layers. She actually does at one point does try to protect him. So even small characters like that have other layers to them as well.
She's Lieutenant Joshi, and she her arc is also very good. And our feelings for her evolve as well. That the film is brilliant in this, and what is, you know, well, Denis Villeneuve just makes incredible movies. His Arrival last year, year before, was just mind-blowing. And now we get this, which just flies in the whole face of what modern filmmaking is. We're so, you know, the superhero genre has really ruined the movie, for me, has ruined movies with its fast cuts and its overabundance on mindless action that has no sense to any weight. There's no consequence for anything. No scene is go ahead.
No, because I'm sorry to interrupt you. Because it's sort of like the same movie. It's like when you watch a movie like Blade Runner and Blade Runner 2049, you want to rewatch these movies countless times because you get to see new things about them. And I like having conversations with you about this because you opened my mind more up to Kay's journey than I thought it was.
I'm glad.
When I first watched the movie, I'm watching it just through just the plot elements. And I'm saying, okay, well, he's trying to discover who he is. Okay, well, there's a horse there. Oh, he thinks he's the child? Wait, now he's not the child. Now he's trying to find out who this girl is. And all right, so when I first see a movie, I'm basically just looking at just the story.
Right.
And then when you go back, you can kind of discover more of the themes that are there. And there's definitely different themes of different characters. I do wish that the Walls character, I kind of wish there was more of a background with him. Now, maybe you'll disagree with me on this, but I do think that he's like one of the weaker characters of this movie because he's not in it that much. All you know is that he's the guy that has created these very subservient replicants. There is a very heartbreaking scene where basically this replicant's being created, and she's coming to life, and she's waking up like a child would awake, and she's trying to establish a world and everything, and trying to establish her own, like, where she is and everything, and then he just kills her off, like, she's just, like, mm-hmm. some sort of, like, cow. And I kind of wish there was, like, a little bit more emphasis, not too much emphasis on him, but just a little bit more of a background, because he's essentially is the new Tyrell, and I don't
know. Yeah.
The only moments that we have with him is near the beginning with Tasha Kay, and then there's the moment when he does interview Deckard near the end, and mm-hmm. this is where you get the reveal of who Deckard actually is, and mm-hmm. they do actually, spoiler alert folks here, they actually do bring in Sean Young
as
Rachel, but you find out that it's not actually Rachel, it's just
another
person just made up look like her, which brings another mystery there too. I mean, what actually did happen to Rachel? Did she not live? Is she hiding? I don't know. Did she die in childbirth? I'm
convinced that Rachel did die. Those were her real bones that they found in the box at the beginning of the film. I'm convinced of that is the truth.
Okay.
I am going to agree with you with the Wallace character. He is the least, and maybe purposefully so, least defined character. He's mentioned in the crawl as being the one who takes over for Tyrell at the start. Mm-hmm. And I guess he's meant to be sort of malevolent and in the shadows. There are two main villains, although one, you know, Joshi is meant to be a villain, but we find out that she's actually been manipulated and there's other avenues. I'll try to keep some of this spoiler free, but the payoff, you're right, is that scene. And that scene is devastating when they bring in Deckard and he's tore up and then in waltzes Rachel, and what they did, I mean, they did a great job with that, right, Vern? I mean, she looked amazing. It was like she stepped right out of the 1982 film. It was just fantastic CGI work there. Mm-hmm. Deckard, his choices when he sees her. The humanity again is exposed here, and that scene with Wallace is the flip side, really, the same side of the scene you talked about with the birthing of that one replicant, that he's got millions of these replicants and he can just casually decide who lives and dies. Maybe there'll be a director's cut, I'm not sure, but I am like you. I really want to explore this movie again. I intend to this weekend go see it again. I'm going to watch it several times, I'm sure, once it gets released on home video. I'm going to really dive in. And I'm sure that there are layers I'm still uncovering layers in the original Blade Runner. I'm still finding
things. I know, right? Yes.
You know? And now that I have 2049, that gives so much more purpose to the original Blade Runner. I mean, okay, you know, I want to give more legs to the fact that I think this is the greatest sequel ever, and giving full props and nods to The Empire Strikes Back, which I thought for a long time was the best sequel, but that is a sequel. It literally continues the story like where we left off. So it's like a long movie, right? Here, 2049 gives purpose to Blade Runner. It actually gives it purpose and defines it better. I mean, what sequel does that? What sequel doesn't, like the Aliens versions, they make different movies every time, but you're still following it. The Rocky movies just continues the same thing, right? I could go on Matrix, where they just continue the story. This is not so much a continuation, but a thing that says, you know what? Blade Runner had more to it. This is what the reason was for why there was Blade Runner. I think that's the most remarkable thing about 2049.
Yes. Fair. I honestly couldn't have said it better myself right there. I do think the movie is a wonderful, it's a continuation of the Blade Runner, and it sets mm-hmm. up new themes too, which I really like about it. And it's one of those movies that it could expand, but yet I don't want them to make this into a trilogy, and that's what I'm afraid about. Even though box office report will say that it won't, but I wouldn't mind seeing another movie set in this world, because mm-hmm. I do think there's like a lot of great themes that happen with this universe that it could evolve into another movie, but I want to see different characters.
Well, yeah, there is talk. You're right, and Harrison Ford has already said that if he likes the script, he's in. Okay. And I don't know really what they could do. Again, it feels like it's a sealed, fully fleshed movie. There is some ambiguity with a brilliant ending, which let's not spoil it. But there's a brilliant ending with Kay, right?
Yes.
And it echoes so much of the ending of the original, same musical theme. Instead of rain, it's snow this time, and you're like, okay, what happened? And I was just tingling. I was like, oh my God, this is the best moment. And I think that itself leads to possibilities, but will it be done smartly? Now, I want to ask you, Vern, have you seen Blade Runner Blackout 2022, the animated short?
I did see that one, yes. Oh. I really kind of enjoy the one because it does kind of set up what happened before the story of Blade right there. Characters going to, I just explode this thing. It's basically going to shut down.
Yeah, it's just a 15-minute short. Shinichiro Wanatabe does this really great animation story that kind of fills in the gaps, right? Well, a little more towards the original version of, and then the uprising and the effects of that. But I think it's worth seeing. If you're a fan of both of these films, I would say seek out Blackout 2022. It's only 15 minutes. It might help fill in some of the gaps. But
I have a feeling too that if there ever was, I mean, there already is artificial intelligence. I mean, there's actually very much human.
We're close.
We're very close right there. In fact, there's a video I'll share later on there too, but there's like a video I saw on YouTube, and it's this woman's face, but she's a robot. And what they do is they put cameras in her eyes, and she's able to respond. You can speak to this robot as a person, and she'll talk back to you. And
yes,
it's very robotic and things like this, but the way that she responds and talks and is able to give her own opinions about this, we are not too far away from having this be a reality. And I have a feeling, too, that if this did become bigger, yes, there would be a lot of people saying that there would be sort of a war between humans and these androids, and people saying that, no, it's all about human life, and these are robots, and they should not have these things there. I can totally see this happening, and this big blackout thing. I mean, it kind of impresses me in a way, and yet it kind of scares me in a way, too. My
mind's
kind of thrown in different things, especially when it comes to basically a computerized being having emotions and, you know, having to care about them. And I think both Blade Runner 2049 as well as the 82 version kind of has you test, you know, your humanity and, you know, how you can treat other people and whatnot.
And then the whole point of 2049 is that thing you're fearing now has the ability to self-replicate, right? That's the thing. It has the ability to make its own young and raise, and that's the scary part. Are we talking about the replacement of human beings? Is Earth now home to this new species? And that's what it is. I mean, the whole point of this movie is that replicants, because of Deckard and Rachel, are now a viable species, right? Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah. How they're going to basically connect with our species. Is it going to be a thing because can, like, a human have sex with a replicant too and have a humanoid child right there?
They are. I mean, they already are, right? Cause, I mean, Pris. Pris is a pleasure robot. Pris was made in the original version to be a pleasure. That was her whole point. She was built on Valentine's Day, and she's made to be a pleasure robot. So yeah, it's already happening. I'm sorry, let me continue, but it's echoed a little bit in 2049 because Kay has the holographic girl in his house, right? So it's in emotional sex, I guess, emotional romance there. So
were you reminded of her a little bit, that sequence when the actual android shows up and she has to, like, superimpose herself over the android body right there? I totally thought about her when they hire the prostitute.
Oh, yeah, completely. I didn't even think about the Mackenzie Davis character. I was only thinking about Joy the whole time. That's what's so great about that moment, right?
Yeah, because they put the thing. But I just started thinking about when they do hire the prostitute in the movie Her, Spike Jonze's Her.
Oh, right, that one. Yeah, same movie, right? Same concept, right? Yes. Yeah. Yes.
In fact, I kind of feel like both movies, it gets a lot of like ideas in your head right there, and I'm still in my head trying to process the whole thing right there. Like, trying to get into a relationship with some sort of being. I don't know, but I would totally buy that device.
Of course. Why would you not, right?
You know, and how this hot girl kind of like walked around with her, being in different outfits, and she can manage my counters. All right, Alexa. That's going to be the next stage of Alexa. I want Alexa to look like that, okay?
Well, we'd have to come up with a, you know, it can't be gender biased. We've got to have one that has both genders and or more. The more options are everywhere, right? Could be anything, right? So, yeah, it's going to happen. I mean, I hate to admit it. I mean, you read these articles, it's the sex industry is driving real life. Robots. I mean, the advancements in robotics for the sex industry is astonishing what they're doing. So who knows, man? The AI is going to be something we're going to have to deal with. Our children's children are going to really have to deal with this sort of thing. So
this movie, excited about it. I'm a little scared, but also very excited about this. And we should mention too, I think Blade Runner 2049. It would be the type of movie that young people are going to watch, and they're going to be so influenced by it, just like a lot of filmmakers were when they saw the first Blade Runner. I have a feeling that a lot of film lovers, young people, are going to see this movie, and they're going to be just like blown away by the.
I hope
like,
so.
Holy shit, I can tell stories like this. Stories just going to have to be cash grabs, and they can actually say something and have meaning to them, and. I can actually create a real story with real human emotions to them.
Okay. Right.
And maybe there'll be like a new renaissance because the original Blade Runner, without Blade Runner, there would be no like Matrix.
So much to be missing. Yeah.
Ghost in the Shell. A lot of like cyber Matrix. There'd be no Matrix without, just a lot of good cyber noir sci-fi films too. That basically, or even. A lot of like dramas and horror films that do use the same type of establishing shots. I think the same thing will happen with Blade Runner 2049. The length of the movie, even though it's over like only 3 hours long, it never felt that long. I think the pacing of that movie is just really excellent done.
Go ahead.
No, I'd say the editing is just perfect in that movie. Never feels long at all. I feel like a lot of films want to use the 3-hour length, but they don't need to. And I think this movie just balances everything out.
Superhero movies? movies? Why is a superhero movie two hours and 45 minutes long? Why is that happening? We both mentioned at the start of the 2049 discussion how we wanted people to go to the theater and find a theater that had great audio. Well, let's cap off this podcast by just reinforcing that. Do go to the best theater in your city or your town. Seek out a theater that has the best audio because you know what's happening. This is really cool. I think what's happening with movies these days. And Denis Villeneuve, what he did, Arrival. Did you see Arrival?
I'm sure you did.
Yep. Yeah. So it's the guy, you know, Hans Zimmer is just busting down all these expectations of what a soundtrack is, what a score is. And here, the score that he does with the Benjamin Wallfish it's not even music, right? It's emotion sounds.
There's no theme.
There's no like melody. It's just these enormous body shaking sounds that completely pull you into this universe. And the same thing that he did with Arrival, where these noises and sounds and slight motifs that, you know, kept, you know, reemerging here and there. So emotive, right? It's so different from your classic music or movie score, right?
When I saw it at the Dolby Cinema, and this one, the sound engulfs you because when the bass hits you, your seat shakes.
Yeah, you just shake, right? It's just...
There's a one moment or two where they're going in the speeder and the speeder goes underwater and it goes back up and it comes back down again. I felt like I was going in and out of water. And it's kind of cool too when the racer came up out of the water and the water kind of splashed on the ceiling, you could hear the water kind of splashing on the ceiling of the theaters. And I was just totally immersed. Did you see this in IMAX or just theaters?
IMAX was not showing it. So I did see it in a theater with that Dolby Atmos.
Yes.
Which has got like 350, literally like 300 speakers in the surrounding in front of it. So, and I made sure to sit myself somewhere in the middle and the back, and it was just like, you just transformed by the sound of this film. It's fantastic.
Yeah. I do know, I think I'm going to go see this movie again this weekend, but I'm going to go see it in IMAX because we actually do have the giant IMAX screen, and that's probably, I'm going to have a different experience when I watch the movie, and I'm going to come out of that movie having even more thoughts than I did this first time when I watched it. But I thank you very much for kind of bringing to life Kay's humanity and him searching for his humanity more than what I thought was just a simple chase movie. And it's definitely more than that. But to be fair, when I first watched the movie, I'm just kind of watching it just for the storyline progression, just like I did when I first saw the first Blade Runner. Like I said before, I was really into the visuals of Blade Runner. The storyline of it, though, it just took me a while to get into it, but then each time I watch it, you start to develop new things about it. And that's one of the beautiful things about film. One thing I want to close up here before we do get going here is the fact that Martin Scorsese has come on attacks of things like CinemaScore and Rotten Tomatoes, saying that those sites are same thing as like Consumer Reports, because everyone's all interested in the box office, and if it doesn't have a good enough box office, it's a failure as a movie. And I think movies are something that should be experienced multiple times. I mean, you should be able to go back and see something. There's been movies that I didn't much like when I first saw it, and then you talk to a few people about it. Like, no, watch it, but with this perspective of it. I remind of, like, The Big Lebowski. I wasn't a huge fan of The Big Lebowski. And then a few of my friends like, well, you know what? It's more of a detective story. I'm like, is it? Like, is it? Like, yes, think of it as like a detective noir with the dude as a detective. And I did, and, you know, opened my mind up. And that's what movies should do. So even if a movie does have, even if a movie does have a low score, I don't want that to distract people from watching it, because right now everyone's saying on Twitter and whatnot there that Blade Runner was like a box office bomb, and
It's awful. It's awful. Yeah.
Essentially, so was the first one too, and the first one, through the years, became a much bigger movie. And I still think Blade Runner 2049. You enjoy it. I enjoy it. It definitely does have its fan base there. Throughout the years, it'll get its way more into the culture. I mean, movies don't become hits right away, or movies don't become classics right away.
And nor should they. They need to be earned. And I think that multiple experiences, especially as we ourselves mature, I know that, you know, adding on to what you said, I revisit movies often that I may not have even enjoyed as much the first time through, but given a second chance, even a third chance, as my own sensibilities change, the movies change with me. And I often find myself feeling differently about it. But my appreciation of Blade Runner itself has evolved over the last 30 years as I watch it multiple times. And now it has again. And, you and I are part of ThatMomentIn.com, a movie review site and a commentary site. And I try to, our motto on ThatMomentIn.com is every movie has one great moment. So we try to be very positive and constructive with our view of films. But the modern social media culture is in its 140 character lifestyle now. And we are a hate culture. And I don't want to get too much on it. I think we've talked about it before in one of our earlier podcasts. I think one of the first ones I did with you, is that it's so easy to hate. And so YouTube is populated over and over by videos that tear down movies, tear down stories, and find fault in this and that. And we become so numb to hating everything. where most filmmakers are genuinely trying to make an honest and earnest story with whatever budget they have. And if we can, if, you know, people like you and I, we have a voice. We got a voice on our website. And I think I've had lots of comments from people who write in and say, you know, well, thanks for opening my eyes. I had no idea about that before. I didn't think about it like that before. I didn't realize that before. I just looked at this. And when we engage, and you know, you're doing this great series now, Cinema Recall, which actually gets people to rethink a film, and you get some good guests on there, and you get them to think about movies. Well, that's maybe the first step that we can do in helping people to stop knee-jerk reaction to automatically not liking something. And I agree that, you know, IMDb and Rotten Tomatoes and Twitter and Facebook, they're so congested with, inexperienced, uneducated opinions.
Yeah.
And we hear so many stories of people who've never even seen the movie just clicking, yeah, I hate it too, because of the trailer or what a picture, or I don't like the actor or the actress. And it is becoming a problem. It does influence a lot of people. So I hope that that does change one day. It's really a problem.
Yeah, that's true. Well, we're just going to take our steps we can to improve that. Before we go here, I'll ask one thing. Have you heard about the Blade Runner video game?
I did. I actually have seen it played. I didn't play it myself. A friend of mine had it, and I watched him play a little bit. It doesn't look so good, but where is the new Blade Runner game, right? Where is it?
There should be. And
right?
I've actually watched the whole story of the Blade Runner game, and honestly, I don't think that it's that bad, actually, because it takes place around the same time as the 82 version, and they bring in a lot of voice actors from the original movie. But you play a guy who's hunting these replicants who are killing animals, and it's got the same Vangelis score, and they use a lot of sets from the original Blade Runner. If you're definitely a fan of Blade Runner, I do think go online, look at Blade Runner video game, just watch certain scenes of it. It's kind of fascinating. It kind of is like sort of like a sister side parallel story. Like, I'm such a fan of Blade Runner that I actually do just enjoy watching the Blade Runner game, because you're still set in that world again, mm-hmm. and you get to see certain sets that were not in the movie, which I kind of enjoy about it there, you know.
So. Mm.
But yes,
that's great. Where is the next one, right? Where is the new Blade Runner game? I would play it every day.
Oh, I would too. Oh gosh, and I totally get that soundtrack now. Yeah, we did that soundtrack.
I cannot wait to get that
back and forth my Vangelis right there. But yeah, no, we brought up a lot of good conversations here about Blade Runner, thinking about movie criticism as well, and I totally mm-hmm. on board with us trying to change people's minds about it, because I know a lot of friends of mine, they're really into the box office, and I try and tell them about a good movie. They're like, well, the movie did really bad and I don't want to see it. And they're like, no, but I would never get my friends to watch Blade Runner. I tried. They're not into it. I tried many times.
I know. But I struggle with just getting people to think more carefully, even about independent film. You know, on the website, I talk all the time to filmmakers and actors in independent films, and I got a couple more interviews coming out this week. And these are hardworking people who are really trying to tell a story, and they're competing with studios that are throwing hundreds of millions of dollars into these films, and these people are mortgaging their homes two or three times just to get one movie out, you know, and the problem is that audiences are so dismissive of things that don't appear to be as glossy as a big budget film, right? So I invite people to come to the website and click on the interviews and read what these people have to say. They have a lot of good things to say about what it takes to be a filmmaker, and I hope that, I'll echo what I said earlier. I hope that people begin to change their minds about, being so negative about movies.
Yeah. Well, this is a good segue, too, because coming up next week on Cinema Recall, I'm going to be attending the Twin Cities Film Festival. I'm going there to see a bunch of, independent features, and a few filmmakers have contacted me. Hopefully, I'll meet with them and interview them for the show. But basically, I'm just going to go there, review films, and talk to some of the festival programmers, talk to some of the producers there. I do know there is a blogger named Ruth Maraminis who just got done shooting her first feature short film. So mm-hmm. I'm definitely interested to view her there. But yeah, like you said before, of you interviewing a bunch of actors and filmmakers, I'm going to do my best to try to check out some of these features and talk to these independent filmmakers about what it is to market their films and what
they it's worth do it.
Make their films known there. And I'm going there as mainly like as a fan of movies, and I'll be writing reviews for the site as well as talking about them on thatmomentin.com. So that's kind of happening during like next week, and reviews will post towards the end of the week after I get done watching them and writing it up there. So definitely look for that on the Cinema Recall podcast. Our next episode, we are going to be having guest Jason Soto, who is the host of Lair of the Unwanted, and he has a YouTube channel called CineGamer. On CineGamer, he reviews a board game and then a movie. So
nice.
Kind of a cool thing right there that he does.
Sounds good.
Lair of the Unwanted, he hosts that with Scott Nolan. Scott Nolan wrote a book called From the Bargain Bin, where he basically does reviews on B-movies everywhere from like the 50s to now. It's like the Leonard Moulton and the Roger Ebert of like B-rated movies.
Great.
But I'm going to have Jason Soto on the show, and we're going to be talking about Darren Aronofsky's Requiem for a Dream. Nice. I won the poll a while back there, and I apologize. I haven't been able to post an episode of that, but I was trying to find a guest. As always, if you do want to be a guest on the show, please message me. I'm on Twitter at Video Vanguard, or you can actually visit us on Twitter with Cinema Recall, which is at @cinema_recall. You can find all of our episodes. We are on thatmomentin.com, and I'm extremely thankful to David to allow me to put up the show on his site, and I'm very thankful
great.
For
it's,
that.
It's great to have you on the network. It's great.
This has definitely become my main home is here. You can find our shows on iTunes, we're on Stitcher, we're on Podomatic, and I know there's one of the ones that I'm forgetting about, but those are the main networks where you can find our show. But just go to thatmomentin.com and click on the podcast tab. Also, check out the other like shows there too, the Asian Cinema Film Club.
Yeah, that's a good one. Well. Richard's show. And the Game Warp. We got Game Warp is on there too with Kim Lowe. That's a fantastic podcast. Yeah, it's good stuff. So, before you let me go, can I just jump in real quick? I want to. For anyone else more interested in learning about Blade Runner, go to thatmomentin.com again, and we've got several articles. In fact, there's an extensive. You probably remember, Vern. There's an extensive article I did about the poster. You mentioned the poster. You saw earlier when you first saw the movie. It's a classic John Alvin poster from 1982. And I dissect that entire poster, do some history on it, get some behind the scenes on it. It's a pretty good article.
Yes.
And there's a couple other. We have I do a whole post on what I consider that moment in that film. So go check that out. Lots to do there. So send people to thatmomentin.com and you can learn a lot more about the movie.
Yes. And the way you dissect certain scenes from movies, your written articles there are just amazing there. I still like going through back there and looking at the back catalogs of what you've written on the site. It's actually is one of the best sites out there. So I'm extremely honored to be part of it. But that's going to wrap up our discussion about Blade Runner. Do you agree? Do you disagree? Let us know in the comments right there, and we'll talk about them on the next episode. But that's going to wrap up everything up right now. I'm The Burn. Special guest, David Dupre, the owner and creator of thatmomentin.com, saying goodnight to you all, and hope you have a great weekend, or a great day, or whatever you listen to this, you know, night, weekend, morning. All right. Good night, everybody.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.